Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Jack Ahern to talk about his book, Design with Nature on Cape Cod and the Islands. Jack is a professor emeritus of landscape architecture at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Jack, thank you very much for being here with me today. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Brian.
So before we begin, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Happy to. Yes, I'm a landscape architect. I spent 95% of my career in academia, where I was a professor at UMass Amherst for 35 years. But I also kept my finger in the consulting world, consulting with design offices and some private clients. And I tended to develop a focus on ecological landscape design, working with native plants and native plant communities. So the idea for this book came about around 10 years ago. My wife and I bought a house on the Cape. We had been vacationing there for a lot of our lives and finally had an opportunity to get a place. And we moved into the Cape, into the house, and started spending more time there, obviously. And I became quite alarmed and shocked at what was happening in the practice of landscape architecture, which was becoming very, very standardized, very resource intensive, basically about 180 degrees away from a sustainable direction. So I saw things, people spending a lot of money, a lot of professionals involved in helping people spend that money. And the results were very conventional and very resource intensive. And that is a particular concern on the Cape and Islands, because this is a unique and uniquely fragile ecosystem. The Cape and Islands were formed from glacial deposits after the last ice age, and the soils that were left behind by the glacier are extremely sandy, which creates conditions of low nutrients and low water holding capacity. And in that environment, plant communities have developed that were adapted to those stressful growing conditions. And those plant communities, I would argue, have a distinct character because of the stresses that they endure. They have physiological adaptations to retain moisture. They have slower growth rates. The plants are smaller. excuse me. And they often have other adaptations to reduce water loss, which have visual characteristics. For example, plants with glossy foliage, like northern bayberry, are often valued because of their visual texture. But that texture is really the plants. The plants attempt to reduce moisture loss to the leaves. So this idea of stress is a lot to do with the nature of the Cape, and you know, the weather beaten landscape, the stunted plants, the small diminutive forests. That's all a part of, arguably a part of the natural history of Cape Cod. And you know, since the early 20th century, Cape Cod has been developed as a resort area, and it has brought, you know, tremendous development pressure. And unfortunately, the people that have been coming recently are kind of falling into the standard practice of landscape design that, you know, I say it could be anywhere. You know, it could be anywhere in the Northeast. You know, pick your least favorite place and call it that if you want. I won't name any of those places on my list, but so that's yeah. So I decided to write this book, and it became a labor of love because I was getting close to retirement, and there's a personal quest for me to articulate not just the problem, but to articulate an ecologically based response to that problem by using native plants.
Absolutely. And again, there's quite a bit for us to try to I don't think we could cover it all. You know, for example, the case studies you present are very, 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 and again, for everyone listening, unfortunately, me describing, it's not going to help you. So I would recommend you actually go look at them. But what I think you and I could talk about was, you know, your strategy you propose. But I did want to kind of back up. You mentioned I have it written down as landscapes of anywhere. And so again, I don't think that's a new concept in landscape design, but I guess I personally, and I can't speak for everyone, did not think that that was an issue kind of with some place like the Cape. I think many people, when they hear the Cape, they know what you're talking about. And I think they have that identity in their mind. And so the question I was going to have that I think you started answering is, you know, this doesn't seem to be a new argument or issue there either. You have quite a few very colorful quotes from people talking about this attack on the Cape. So the question I would have had for you is, you know, you said this came about 10 years ago. Do you feel like it's improving, or is with the growth of development, it's getting worse, actually, that standardization?
Sure. I'd like to think it's improving. And maybe, you know, my book has been out for a year, so I don't really think my book has a lot to do with it improving. I'm not that naive. I think it's really about the a related environmental crisis that I also write about in the book, which is the water quality crisis on the Cape. Because of this sand, as I explained, the waste disposal systems that people use for domestic waste, which are known as septic systems, it turns out they're not very good at removing nitrogen from the effluent. So most of the Cape is on septic systems, over 90% of all the houses. So this is a slow moving disaster, because the water from the septic systems goes into the groundwater. It moves slowly from the high points out to the bays, and it pollutes the bays. And we're seeing this in virtually every bay on the Cape. Serious water quality problems. So that's a kind of a background mega problem that the Cape is addressing now. Every town on the Cape is building sewer plants to the tune of billions of dollars. The town I live in, Barnstable, just one town on the Cape, it is the biggest town, but that town has a $1.4 billion plan to build sewer. So this has become very real. And the septic and sewer problem is about 80% of the water quality problem. The other 20% comes down to fertilizers and landscape and stormwater. So that's really the piece that I am aiming at to contribute to the solution. So that's a part of it, that the native plants do not need fertilizer. Therefore, they don't leach away excess fertilizer into the water. The native plants are adapted to dry growing conditions, so they don't need irrigation. So this helps us to save the precious water that should be reserved for drinking water instead of watering lawns. And when you water lawns that are heavily fertilized, the fertilizer leaches down into the groundwater. So that's kind of the main motivation. But there is a movement to celebrate the ecological character of many places. The native plant movement is flourishing around the country. And it really has to do with the argument that I try to make here, you know, that the plants that are native to a locale are part of the identity of that locale. And obviously, they should be used to reinforce and maintain that character. So it's a simple idea. I think what my book brings that is different from others is the focus on design, to shame people with environmental guilt, like, look what you're doing, you're destroying and polluting the landscape and et cetera, but rather, hey, here's a different way to do it that can do the right thing and be beautiful. And that's what I tried to illustrate with the case studies. There's 19 case studies in the book. And a lot of them are publicly accessible, so people can go and look at them and see for themselves.
Absolutely. And again, same with the principles. Again, I wouldn't want to spend all of your time this afternoon quizzing you on all 11 of them. But again, I'm not a landscape architect. I have spoken to a few, and it's funny because you make a good point that I think is pretty common in a lot of the literature, and that is, it seems like the greatest challenge is just public acceptance and education. You make the case, you know, and I think, that lawns are the largest irrigated crop in the U.S., and then you mentioned there are quite a few plants that require no maintenance and are better. They just don't look like the typical uniform green grass, I think, that we see in magazines. And
yes. The native plants have a, you know, I'm sensitive to this and tuned into it. So I find that they have a beauty that that derives from the place, and it's reinforced when you use those plants in designs, and then you can see those same plants looking similarly at any given time of year, whether it's the spring emergence of leaves or the color of the fall or even the winter form, with when we can pay attention to things like branching and bark color and other factors like that. So, yeah, and I think, the title of the book, by the way, is borrowed from my great professor, Ian McCarg, who started and led the landscape architecture program at University of Pennsylvania. And I studied with him because I believed in his message. Excuse me. And his seminal book was called Design with Nature. And it was published in 1969 at the peak of the environmental movement. And it really kind of rocked the world and kind of opened people's eyes to the need for an ecological approach to landscape design. So with great respect to McCarg, I adapted his title to the title of my book. And I feel that he's no longer with us, but I feel that he would approve with my message because I get it. I understand it.
Absolutely. And, you know, you make a good case for there's beauty and there's also functional reasons and there's also the sustainable aspect. Like you said, you know, fake grass takes a lot of water, takes a lot of fertilizer, which in terms, you know, you do make some very startling statistics that even I was not aware about the water issue specifically in the Cape area. But I was wondering, and again, this is a very vague question, I apologize, but, you know, you talk about a few times the importance of resiliency and biodiversity. You know, as you've mentioned, there is sort of a crisis that we can't ignore. And so, again, I know how open-ended that is, but could you maybe talk about the idea of biodiversity in landscape design a little more?
Sure. You know, and it's a little ironic to have to speak about that. Not from a question from you, but from in my field, it's slowly becoming a widely accepted goal and important value of everything that we do. You know, I think it's coming from the evolution and maturation of environmental policy. The contemporary use of the word sustainability really started in the late 80s. The word was around, but it wasn't applied to sustainable development. And since that time, sustainable development has become a policy for lots of organizations. You know, architects are really took the lead. This is a good pun. They took the lead with LEED. Yes. You know, the Green Building Council kind of said, wait a minute, we architects need to be leading the sustainability business. And, you know, buildings are an important part of that. So, you know, thank you, architects. And you kind of jumped out way ahead of landscape architects when we were still arguing that sustainability was bad for business. You know, we build golf courses, damn it, and don't tell us about talk about sustainability or we'll be out of business. And of course, that was proven to be wrong. And now a lot of professionals are, I think, very appropriately making their living out of demonstrating sustainability can be real and it can be beautiful. And, you know, that's the designer's part of the argument. But back to biodiversity that you mentioned, I think this is one of the factors that continually evolves within the discourse on sustainability and resilience. And certainly the United Nations that does the important work of, you know, global assessment of sustainable development goals and biodiversity, you know, they have pushed the panic button that, you know, we are in the midst of a great extinction of species globally. The sixth great extinction might be a little hyperbole, but I don't think so. I think it's very real. And we all depend on biodiversity a lot more than most of us can even imagine. So it's an important factor and value to put into your work. It's one of the harder sells. You know, on the Cape, people are sensitive to water quality because it's a recreationally oriented economy. You know, so whether people go to enjoy it or make money from it, the clean water is important for everybody's livelihood and fun. Biodiversity, less so. So that's part of an education of why should we, you know, it's and there are certainly national/international trends that are moving in the right direction. For example, pollinators, right? 10 years ago, you wouldn't have heard anything about pollinator crisis. And pollinators, oh, I get it. They pollinate flowers, right? But now we've come to learn that there's a pollinator crisis, and it's not only a crisis for agriculture, but for all forms of plant life. And we need to plant in, to change this, we need to establish plants in our landscapes that can support pollinators. That's just one of the very kind of resonant ideas about sustainability. When you can attach it to something that people kind of inherently feel good about, it's good marketing, right? You know, like when you talk about biodiversity, don't talk about snakes, you know. Talk about warm fuzzy mammals or butterflies, right? And then people can get on board. So a little bit of a marketing dimension, but I believe it's a really core argument that supports all of this. And if I could jump into one more issue here, Brian, is a climate change. You know, I was writing this book. It took me about 10 years to finish it. And, you know, things change over 10 years. And the discourse over climate change certainly has changed a lot in the last decade. So that caused me to address that. It's not a focus of the book, but I think I touched on it in many places, that by using native plants and plant communities, you not only support the biodiversity, but these plants are going to be much more resilient against climate change. And on the Cape, the reason for that is that it's already a stressful environment. So, you know, imagine a plant like American beach grass sitting out on a dune in total sun, getting sprayed by salt spray, growing in pure sand with virtually no capacity to hold water. You know, that's a stressful growing environment. And those plants can go year after year through drought after drought because they have adapted to those conditions. The beach grass knows that it has to put down really deep roots to get those little bits of water that they'll need. And there are other species also, including pitch pines, that are adapted to fire. That's a common occurrence in landscapes that are sandy. So a lot of these plants, I say they are pre-adapted to climate change, and they're very well positioned to survive the future extremes that we're expecting and that we're increasingly seeing every year, like droughts and intense rainfall.
No, I appreciate all. And so one thing you had mentioned, you had said it a few times, was the idea about education and demonstration. And so, as I said, I don't want to take up all of your time today, you know, talking about all of your principles, but I think there's two that stuck out to me. I didn't mention this to you, and I didn't mean this as a surprise. I went to graduate school at UMass. And so when I walked to the architecture building, I often walked through the demonstration, the garden there, and I don't know what it was really called. And so a former guest that was on the show, Fred Delcombe and James Ellis, they had talked about, and again, you could speak to it too with your academic background, they were in charge of the campus landscaping. And for the longest time in academia, you had very beautiful, pristine lawns. There was no prairies. There was no wild grass. And so it was a slow grind, but they had mentioned finding success and setting up educational and demonstrated gardens, as well as making the case that, you know, it's a lot less money and time to deal with them. And so one of your principles, you talk about, you know, inspiring and educating. And so are you proposing literally large public demonstrations of kind of, I'll call them prairies, you know, not as uniform grass? Is that what you propose with that?
Well, thanks for that question. I think something I feel pretty strongly about. There are actually, among the case studies, there are three of them that are small-scale demonstration projects. One of them I designed, and the other two were designed and installed by nonprofit environmental groups. Both in all three are in highly visible locations. All three of them have signage on site, so that in it's both a confrontational strategy. You know, like you walk down the street in Chatham, which is a kind of a conservative Cape Cod looking town, and you see in the middle of town you see this meadow, like, you know, what is that? Well, then they have, it's the Chatham Trust, the Conservation Trust, and they have a sign that says, yeah, we're growing native plants because they're a part of the character of the Cape and they're important for this and that. So that's one straightforward way to do this, you know, outside of my book, right? You don't need, and by having the interpretation there, people can learn from it. So the one that I did, we put two interpretive panels, and we included QR codes so that people who are interested can just scan that code and go to the website where there's all kinds of information about the species, the particular species, their characteristics, and so forth. So that's one way to get it into the discussion. And then when you have these demonstration sites, you can add them into garden tours and hold events where you have programs where you can tell people about this idea and, you know, kind of in the flesh to look at the plants and point to them. And you can do those when things are really exciting in the middle of the summer and you have flowers and pollinators all over the place. So that's a pretty powerful tool. The large scale landscapes, I think that's a part of it. And that's why I included projects that are already built that I feel that show that, like the Polly Hill Arboretum on Martha's Vineyard and the Tea Ticket Park in Falmouth. That was a former driving range. It was a low budget park, and the designer said, "Hey, let's just grow native plants here because we don't need to bring in $1 million worth of topsoil. We can plant in the crummy sand that was underneath this driving range, and it worked, and it's beautiful." So I think as a part of changing people's perception, the pilot projects are really important. And
No, I agree. As I said to everyone listening, take a look, don't just listen to us talk about it. And so again, of course, I would love to talk about the other 9 or 10 we didn't talk about, but the principles, not case studies. But you had mentioned that, you know, this was what you've been working on for 10 years and it came out a year ago. And so, you know, I guess the question is what's been occupying your time since then? You know, other projects on the rise?
I've been on a little bit of a book tour on this. As we're still kind of coming out of the pandemic and things aren't full blown, but I've given a number of talks to local groups and local bookstores, and the interview with you today is all part of kind of promoting the book. So that's a part of it. As a retired academic, I'm not quite ready to hang up my spurs yet. I want to do some new things. And my new idea is couldn't be farther away from this. It's the idea of the issue of spontaneous plants in cities, the kind of the accidental nature that that comes in and grows in vacant lots and ruins of buildings and abandoned parking lots. And, you know, most people would call these weed patches. But there's something interesting ecologically that happens in these weed patches, we can call them that, because these plants are, you know, talk about stressful conditions. These plants are really models of resiliency, and some of them can even tolerate growing in polluted environments. And some of those are even capable of removing toxins from the soil in those environments. So when I look at all these factors, I say, whoa, we're not thinking creatively and constructively about this issue yet, where there seems to be a binary response, which is either, I don't see it, I don't care, I'm not going to do anything about it, or let's do something about it, which means kill it, kill everything and replace it with turf grass. And so Philadelphia, for example, is doing a lot of cleaning up abandoned lots and putting turf grass and split rail fences in them. And I get it, that stops people from dumping trash in them. It stops crack dealers from setting up shop in the back or behind trees. And, you know, it's a complicated issue. But I think there's room for some creative, informed work to intervene in these landscapes, to not just to either kill them or abandon them, but to work with them and to manage them for different purposes, for pollinator habitat, for phytoremediation, to clean the soil, and to look better, just for people walking by that they can look better. So I'm just getting started on this. The Europeans are kind of the leaders in this. The best work that I've found so far is in Paris and Berlin. And I'm going to try, this gives me an excuse to travel a bit and to research. And I like to, kind of like this book, my writing style involves thinking about big broad theoretical issues and kind of articulating those ideas, maybe proposing a new approach to those ideas, like I did in this book, and then illustrating what others have done through case studies. So that's what I did in this book, and that's probably, if the other one comes to a book, that's likely what that will be as well.
Oh, interesting. Maybe we'll talk about that someday.
Yeah, it's the opposite of native plants, like literally. But you know, and I have mixed feelings about that because you know, on the Cape, the native plants, it's not a lost cause. It's still at a point where it could be turned around and moved into a different direction. When we look at some older cities, you know, especially European cities, nature has been so beat up and abused and manipulated over centuries that there's nothing left that is remotely resembles the native vegetation. So it's a new idea about a cultural landscape and thinking about how to how designers can intervene. That's what we do, right? We like to make interventions, and I think there's a lot of work yet to be discovered in that area.
Again, sounds very interesting. I have to keep my eye out for that.
Yeah, well, give me a couple of years. Okay? That's right.
Well, I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today.
My pleasure, Brian. And let me. Are you in the Amherst area still, or?
I am not. No.
Well, nope. If you get back, let me know. I'll be happy to give you a tour. We're very proud of our new landscape at the design building.
I'll have to take you up on that sometime.
Yeah, I would be happy to share that with you.
Good. And for everyone listening, the book is Design with Nature on Cape Cod and the Islands. Thank you very much for listening and have a great day.
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure. Take care.